Thanks for tuning in to our podcast series, Scaling Without Borders. As a pan-European PR agency, we've supported many companies in their journey to expand to other markets. In this series, we take a deep dive into how scale-ups can grow their business beyond their home country. We'll shed a light on this challenge from different perspectives. Entrepreneurs who have already successfully done this, the investor community funding these ambitious people, and the startup ecosystem supporting them. This first season, we focus on the Dutch scale-up community. What are their insights on how to scale abroad successfully? All to inspire other entrepreneurs to perhaps do the same.
Hello, and welcome to Scaling Without Borders. In this podcast series, we interview some of Europe's leading experts in the startup community to learn from their experience and understand their vision on how to successfully grow a startup or scale up across borders. In today's episode, we are joined by Harm Solt, partner and head of technology investments at Menta Capital, a leading European private equity firm with a strong track record in market consolidations and operational transformations. Harm started his career at PeopleSoft, Flash Oracle, and had various strategic international positions in companies like Nokia, Alcatel-Lucent, and Smart Shift Technologies, for which he also resided in France and in the US. His experience provided him with many valuable insights into how tech companies can navigate growth challenges. Harm now applies these insights on a daily basis, supporting ambitious management teams at the Menta portfolio companies. I'm Chantal, and I'm a senior partner at Taito, and I'm joined today by Eric, who's a senior partner as well.
Thank you, Chantal, and welcome to the Scaling Without Borders podcast. Harm, thank you for joining us.
Hi.
So let's start off right away. What role actually can private equity play internationally scaling a company, mainly a tech business? What do you provide exactly?
Well, I think to start with, it depends on which private equity you are partnering with. There are a few sorts and sizes of private equity where we at Menta are working in, and it's a market that there are several private equities in the Netherlands or in Europe that are doing it. Is in the lower mid-market. So it's companies, depending on the sector, of probably around between 10 and 30 million euros of revenues. Sometimes go a little bit lower or a little bit higher. And what we're doing is helping them with a few things. To start with is organic growth, either nationally or internationally. Acquisitive growth, so growth through acquisition of companies in different countries or different territories. But what usually the basic of what we offer are a few capabilities that we bring on board that help companies become better as they scale. It goes around operational and financial discipline. It's access to a very large network of experts and connections that we have outside of the local markets. Strategic guidance. Usually companies sort of grow when we join them. They sort of grew by having a founding team or a founder that had a clear vision of where they want to achieve. And then they sort of reach a ceiling, and we help them break through the ceiling and make it go faster. So it's strategic guidance around long-term planning, around expansion strategies, sometimes around products and pricing, commercial, how do you open new sales offices? So it really depends on the company, around the discipline of finance, commercial, and people, and strategy overarching all of them.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. And well, of course, some entrepreneurs need money from day one, but at what stage a scaling journey does provide private equity typically come on board?
So again, if you look at the sort of the financial path that the company goes, if we're looking at the money path, so you'll have your early stage investors, the angels. You'll have seed rounds that may come either from angels or VCs. Then you usually see a path either direction of growth capital, which is actually, and once you understood your commercial engine, you need something to growth. So it's either commercially around scaling up production in certain companies or but anything that will allow you to grow faster. And then comes PE from our size to the really big ones like KKR, for instance. I think that where we usually come in is once the business has proven itself that it found the product market mix. So it actually knows what to sell, which problem they solve, and to which audience. And once they've done that and are cash flow positive and have the ambition to scale that beyond that position, this is where we usually come in.
Okay. And so if you look at Dutch tech companies that want to expand abroad, so what market would typically be attractive for these companies, and what factors make them more attractive?
Look, I think the advantage that we have in the Netherlands is that it's a relatively small market if you compare it to Germany or the UK or France, definitely the US. But it's a market that is absorbs technology very fast and likes technology. So if you look at, usually when companies look at market to try things out and to see if things work, the Netherlands is a very good market for that. We are, for instance, the highest adoption of Microsoft technologies. We like, as the Dutch market likes, being on the more cutting edge technologies. So it's a nice market to be in, because you know that if you've successfully launched something in this market, you can you're slightly ahead of other markets. You have some markets in the Nordics, some segments in the UK, but the Netherlands in general has a strong central position, very international, so a lot access to other languages and cultures, and fast adoption of technology, which makes it an interesting market to start with, and then take that knowledge and capabilities and expand them beyond the Netherlands. I think the most important thing is, if you ask me which market specifically, again, it is very broad. I think the main point is, do you need to understand which problem you solve, preferably in the market which is lagging, and then show how you can do it faster, better, cheaper. And if you actually master that, your chances of successfully expanding beyond your local market are much, much bigger.
So could it also be that the fact that the Netherlands is kind of at the forefront of technology adoption, could it be that it would, for instance, be harder to expand to Germany, which is more known for being more risk averse and not so adaptive to these new technologies?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And
the German market is sort of Valhalla that everybody wants to be in. But it's not an easy market. To start with, it's not a single market, Germany. Germany has several markets. It's very regional. So if you're good in Munich, it doesn't mean that you'll be successful in Düsseldorf. That's one thing. Second is that there are, depending on which segment of technology, they are 3 to 5 years behind where we are in the Netherlands, in most markets. So sometimes you're just, you know, too shiny, too fast for some of the German adoption. And then you have to be very local or very smart, or solve a very, very clear in which problem you solve. And then you can be successful in Germany.
Okay. And if you would look for markets that are like more similar to the Netherlands, or would be more, well, easier to scale up to, would we then be looking at the Nordics, or then the US even?
Nordics, UK, in certain segments, Spain. They're relatively open to other countries. France, if you have a French angle one way or another, it's a very interesting market. But again, it's an acquired taste. US is a very attractive market, but very competitive. Again, these are all moves that are very relevant, but again, it needs to make strategic sense. Strategic sense, and you have to do your homework well, and also know that it's never easy opening in your market. So it takes time and it takes effort.
Well, time and effort and a lot of funds. I guess. So in talking about that, if you would go abroad and you would need, well, extra capital funding, where would you typically do that? Would you like seek for funding in your home market or look at what the possibilities are in the market you you wish to conquer?
Depends on what you're trying to achieve in your growth, in your growth scenario. So let's say if, you know, priority number one is penetrate the US market and create a substantial presence there, you would want a partner that has done it, knows the market, has the links, and can help you do that. But it's true for any strategic initiative you have as a business. So I think it's more important to find a partner that actually understand your strategic priorities, 2, 3, 4 of them, and can help you drive that. So your partner has to be able to help you get there. Whether it's from local market or from your target market, it depends on how big it is and how complex it is. And it might be that you'll need like a mix of partners. But it's not, there is no, you know, straight answer. It's either this or that. It's more, you need, it's always handy to have a partner who knows what your strategic priorities are and be fully aligned on them and can help you to work through them.
All right. And you are, of course, in charge of the tech portfolio at Menta. How do you assess whether a tech company's platform or technology is scalable enough to handle international growth?
I think that a few of the basic processes have to be in place. They don't have to be perfect, but there must be a process and a way of working with it. I think that one of the biggest challenges that you see in scaling is sort of breaking the 100 people, single or dual or local location barrier. The moment that you get abroad, you start introducing complexity into your system. So for instance, if you don't have a CRM system, if you don't have a sales methodology, if you don't have a proper data definition, if your finance team is not up to speed. So there are a few things that you have to get properly done, or at least 80% done, in order to be able to successfully scale abroad, because scaling abroad just brings additional complexity. Unless you serve it from, you know, your local infrastructure and just, you know, doing telesales abroad or online channels abroad and drop shipping in that market. But the moment that you're looking at servicing customers there about local touch points, local sales organization, local delivery, local, whatever local you need, it's easier to do and it's less messy if your basic processes are scalable and transferable.
And you have other type of companies within the portfolio of Menta as well, of course. Is a tech company easier to scale up than other sectors, or?
No. I mean, we have product companies. So, for instance, Firehouse is the parent company of the Bastard, for instance, the barbecues. It's a company that was very successful selling this product across Europe. It's a great product, a great image, high quality in markets that are looking for these products. So it's not per definition. Technology is not easier. I think that what you get with technology, very specifically around software or SaaS, is that it's much more portable. So your cost of expanding into new markets are, and the speed of being able to expand into new markets, and the low cost of trying and failing makes it much easier to do.
Right.
So for instance, with the barbecue, you have to look for dealerships and you have to sell into stores and you have to, there's a lot of effort and capital invested in kicking it off. If you have a SaaS product that is easy to use, is easy to onboard, it's much easier to start doing digitally or with a very small effort, see what works, see what doesn't work, fix it, adapt it to the local market, and then start scaling.
Right. Now you have helped companies become successful on a scale much bigger than they ever imagined. And then there's a point to say goodbye to them. At what point do you typically exit?
There is no real point that we say we're exiting. It really is a natural process. Typically, we partner with companies for a period of 5 to 7 years. Sometimes a little bit earlier. Sometimes it's a little bit later. But usually it's a 5 to 7 year journey. At a certain moment, I think on both us and the management team reach a sort of a natural point that we sort of everything that we could help the company with it was done, and now it's time for somebody else to help them through their next growth phase and support them on their strategy. Usually it's around, you know, 5 to 7 years. We usually bring companies towards the 100 million above or below, but around that range. And then companies need another partner than us. And then it's a very natural process, actually.
Okay. And we just talked about if it's easier scaling up a tech business than another type of business. But if you look within the tech sector, there's specific different areas like fintech or AI or SaaS. So would you say that one of these has like a particularly strong opportunity for easier scaling, or it doesn't really matter what type of technology it is?
It doesn't matter what technology is. The biggest question is the sort of solution that you have. So for instance, if you look at you know, one of the of the former companies I worked with, Unit 4 had an international business and a domestic business. What you have to take care in international is that you have a product which is scalable beyond a certain market or a certain niche. So for instance, there it was an ERP system for people-centric industries, so basically service industries. And the same issues you have in the Netherlands, you have in the Nordics, you have in the UK, and you'll have in the US. So it's a single product that you can sell in multiple markets. But you also had, for instance, Verzuimsignaal, which is a very specific Dutch legislative issue around labor, long-term illness, or certain accounting software, certain legal software. There are a lot of software that are AI and SaaS and fintech, but they are super local. But if your market niche is big enough, you know, if in your home market, you know, your addressable market is in the billions, you can still create a very nice local company that is very, very successful in a small captive market, depending on the solution that you're solving or the problem that you're solving.
So would you say, I mean, there's more and more legislation is done on a European level. So would you say that really helps companies that offer like more domestic local solutions, but that will be like subject to European legislation, will help them scale more easily?
Because look around GDPR, look around carbon, all the carbon taxing that is done in Europe. There's definitely an advantage of a local company, and you see that eventually other markets are adopting it. So GDPR, US-based companies have to comply with GDPR. There are a lot of solutions that are being done in Europe because it's very early on before the rest of the market thinks, okay, we have to take it seriously. So there are advantages of being here and being ahead of the curve. So it's a first mover advantage that you have.
Okay. So I learned that in a previous interview, you talked about a company, or you compared a company with an execution engine.
Yeah.
What elements are most important to you to speed up that engine? Which elements do you typically touch upon?
I think the whole idea of a very scalable company, and it's something that I used to tell my teams always. Think about it like a cookie factory. So if you know what's the unit in versus the unit out, and if you master that path from, if I put a euro in, I get three out, then you basically have unlimited budget. Because you just know that if you put one in, you get three out. And if this is what you want to achieve, you just go as hard as you can. So I think the point is that figure out the processes that are driving your company. Understand your unit economics, the revenue, the cost, the margin, the cost of customer acquisition, the lifetime value, and create an organization which is data driven. So understand, don't constantly, we see a lot of entrepreneurs that really manage the company, you know, once a quarter, they look at the P&L. Usually what they're really good at is managing the cash at the bank, which is fantastic, because if you don't have cash, you can't run a business. But if you're trying to accelerate, you have to be really good at understanding your leading indicators and how these leading indicators convert to lagging indicators, to your P&L and balance sheet and cash flow forecast. And understanding this process, so for instance, if you know I put a euro into marketing, I get 10 leads, I get two deals out of it. If you understand that flow of resources that you put in the company and what it actually delivers eventually on the P&L, gives you the possibility to navigate the business very, very quickly, but also to accelerate really fast once you understand that something is working. It allows you to try things. It gives you so much power in actually driving your business and not only surfing along with the wind.
So it's a matter of constantly monitoring those like different indicators instead of just, well, looking at them like once a month or
it really is about being in the driver's seat, not only because you're with the market or you accidentally did a few good deals or you have a founder that is really good at bringing stuff in, but if you want to make it scalable, you have to really understand what are the leading indicators you need to track, what are the things that are important for you to steer the company with. And if you know these and the ratio between how they convert from leading indicators to lagging to your P&L, then you have a well-managed company that can scale extremely fast. And we have at the moment, and this is what I really like with what's happening with technology around data these days, is that there are so many really nice solutions that allow you to do it even in a messy IT landscape, even with legacy systems, even if you're not there, there is so much technology available today that allows you to do these predictive things, to understand trends within your data without having a massive data capabilities within your organization.
All right, that's interesting. That was going to be my next question, actually, because having worked abroad and experiencing other cultures, what strategies do you recommend for companies or entrepreneurs to effectively adapt their business models to these different cultural and business preferences as well? Is that looking at the data?
It is. To start with, I think that I haven't seen a lot of different business models when you transfer business model changes, transferring from one country to another. You sometimes have, you know, going direct to going indirect. So go through a channel, for instance, in a specific markets. But I think the most important thing is be open to cultural differences. Be open to the fact that your culture as a company that was very Dutch, for instance, which is very direct communication style, or very preppy, may not work with a different team in a different market. So make your culture something which has deeper values so that you can adapt to the changes that local, the diversity that local markets bring to your corporate culture, and allows you to communicate well within the different parts of the organization as you internationalize. This is extremely important. And then be sensitive to the local culture, be sensitive to how do you sell, how do you communicate. I worked a lot in France and I worked a lot with French. I really enjoy this market. There are people who can't stand this market and find it very difficult to work with French. But France is one of the things that I learned. If the French are really negative around something, it means that they are highly vested and very involved. So while you'll work with an American and you'll go, oh, it's great and it's fantastic, the French will be very negative and very critical. So the intention from the American and the French would be the same. The way to communicate it is completely different. And I think that this is something you just have to be sensitive to and understand in how you work with these cultures.
So you have seen an awful lot of successful and a little bit less successful companies and entrepreneurs. What does it take for an entrepreneur to successfully scale his company, or what's typically holding them back?
What's typically is holding them back? I think a few things. I think that ego can be a big thing. It really takes a different type of skills to bring a company from 0 to 20 million, from 20 to 50 to 70 million, and from 100 million to 500 million. You really need different skills to that. And there are really few people who can actually do the full scale of going from 0 to 1 billion. You know, it's really easy to say, okay, Mark Zuckerberg did it, and I don't know, the Google guys did it. Yes, but it's, these are tiny anecdotes in millions and millions of enterprises and entrepreneurs that actually are very good at 0 to 20, or scale ups from 20 to 100, and then beyond 100. But these are the understand these limits, and understand if you want to grow beyond it, where are your blind spots? Where are you not good at? And then take care that you have a team that can help you get there. Because sometimes just being the visionary, being the ambassador, the big ambassador outside into the company, outside of the company, and then into the company, being the sort of culture carrier, can go a long, long way. But you need to let your ego go. I think if I look at the journeys that we're going through with our companies, you always go through four crises or four sort of crises. So in the beginning, you sort of have the product market fit. So there's a lot of creativity in it. And the moment that you scale beyond it, you start getting into a leadership crisis. So there's a very small team, and then you get into it. This is pre-R time, pre-private equity. But then you start giving more direction to the company. You started having a bit of, you know, people to the left and to the right of the founder that do stuff. And then you guys start getting into the crisis of autonomy. Then you scale through delegating stuff. So you get your middle management in place. You get into a crisis of control. So suddenly you give people the responsibility to do stuff, but you want to be sure that they're doing the right thing, that all the noses are going in the same direction. You need a system, you need a little bit of processes. So you're introducing a few things that you didn't need in the beginning, but in order to scale beyond that, you do need. And once you have this, and then this is usually like between the 20 million and 50 million, 60 million, and then you start getting into coordinating. So you go from direct to more of a governance model of management. And then what you usually see is red tape. So you start losing the agility of the company, and people started, you know, well, you can't do that because it's written in procedure 372. And this is exactly the stuff you don't want to have. So you start getting into the red tape. And then you usually have variations of these crises beyond that point. But if you're looking at sort of the 20 to 100 million, these are crises that we see every single time. And sometimes they go after each other, and sometimes they go together with each other, but you always go through them.
It's also the case, right, that the founder isn't necessarily the best CEO. That's what you often see, right?
Yeah. Well, some of them do. It depends on, but you also very often you see founders that go, that would go and say, okay, I want to do sales. I want to do products. I want to do strategy. I want to expand it to new markets. So these are the things that you'll see founders sort of taking a sort of a sidestep instead of being the CEO of the company.
Yeah, sometimes allows them also to do more fun stuff, I guess.
Exactly. And at a certain moment, being an entrepreneur is really hard work.
Yeah.
So some people at a certain moment say, okay, I want to focus more on the stuff I really like doing when the company was still smaller. It can be products, it can be strategy, it can be a few times we had people that said, you know what, just let me do sales. I don't want to manage people anymore. I don't want to do anything. Just let me go outside and sell. It's fine.
Yeah,
well, I find it very mature and extremely strong if somebody actually says, you know, this is what I'm good at and this is what I'm not.
Yeah. Well, whatever contributes to the company then as well.
Yeah.
So, and the area that most people don't like getting into is legislation. So we just learned like the Dutch Minister of Economic Affairs, he has announced that he wants to bring new technologies within the scope of the Security Screening Act for investments, mergers and acquisitions. So do you think this will negatively impact investments in the Netherlands?
I think that in the, and again, this is my own personal opinion. I think that in the short term, it can create a hurdle. But in the long term, and specifically, it's if it's managed well and in a pragmatic way, there is a massive benefit to it. I think that we're living in a world which is more challenging. There's a lot of seen and unseen involvement of countries like Russia and China and in some cases smaller players, US, depending on who will end up being president, will have a certain view on and technology use and access to technology. So I think it would be naive not to do something about it. I think in the short term, it can be a challenge. Long term, I think it's a wise move. You just need to do it right and be very pragmatic about it.
Well, in the Netherlands, we also see a lot of consolidation of IT providers. I mean, also thanks to, companies like Menta. So would it be too bold to state like consolidate or die? Or do you think relatively small tech companies can still survive on their own?
It depends on what your play is and where you are. So I've seen a lot of companies which are more of a lifestyle business. Look, if somebody has a company with 20 people that generates nice cash flows and everything runs smoothly, nobody is stressed, the market is there for the coming 10, 15, 20 years. It's a great business. If this is what your ambition is, it's great. No need to consolidate, no need to rock the boat. This thing will just keep generating cash. You know, you have your house, you have your vacations, you have a good life. Why change? If you are very ambitious, then there is a rule of eat or be eaten. And then it becomes very relevant. So depends on what you want to do with your business, what your strategy, what your personal ambition is. And then think and understand also what happens in the landscape that you're working in. If you suddenly see that there is a consolidation happen, you should ask yourself, what sort of a business and how do I fit in the move that you see in the market? But it's not consolidate or die. It might be in some cases where you look at some of the legacy technologies at a certain moment, the market sort of becomes hyper consolidated. And then for a very small player, it becomes very difficult to exist. But that's, again, it's very late in these cycles. But be aware of what's happening in your market and decide if you see the market around you consolidates, make a decision, you know, eat or be eaten.
Yeah, I think it's also the same case maybe from a talent acquisition perspective, right?
Definitely.
If companies around you consolidating and creating like more interesting career paths for professionals, it may become really hard for you to retain your employees or, well, hire new ones. So, yep. Yeah, should all be factored in.
Yes.
So, I think a final question. I can imagine quite some entrepreneurs will be listening to this podcast and they're listening to the interesting things you have to say. So what are the, say they need money, they need private equity to scale their company. What are the factors they need to take into account before they call you?
Well, to start with, it needs to be a cash flow positive company. That's the first question we'll ask. Are you making money, yes or no? If you're not, you probably need an earlier investor, a VC or seed capital. But if you're making money, if you're very ambitious as an entrepreneur, you have a good offering that solves a real problem in the local market, and you're operating in a market that has a growth potential, then we're always interested to talk to you.
That's good to know. Well, thank you, Haran, for giving us insight into this dynamic world of private equity. The last half an hour, 40 minutes, I have learned already quite some things as well. And that it's not only about the money, but also about the practical help you as mentor are giving entrepreneurs and companies in total. And to partner up aligned with your strategy. I think that's the most important lesson from this podcast, at least. I hope that the entrepreneurs that those are listening, that that they take this into account and perhaps they will call you quite soon.
Sure. They know where to find me.
I hope our listeners enjoyed this conversation with Haran as much as we did, actually. And if you want to know more about scaling up, please tune in for other episodes in this series. And if you have any feedback on this episode, contact the Taito team on LinkedIn or comment on the video episode of this podcast on YouTube. And you can also drop us an email at hello@taitopr.com. And thank you for listening and see you soon.